From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. If you play football, research shows you might end up damaging your brain.
When you get a spinal cord concussion, your head, it just like flops back and forth. And it felt like 100 bees was on me, stinging me.
JerMichael Finley was a tight end for the Green Bay Packers for 6 seasons. He got 5 concussions. Ahead this hour, we talk about the latest science on football head injuries and changes to that sport. But first, we talked yesterday about white rage and racism in Donald Trump's America.
The Trump campaign and the president himself sort of lifted the lid on a sewer, and it came erupting out. And what you're seeing in Charlottesville is a piece of that.
That's Brett Stevens, a conservative columnist for the New York Times. Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Jo Lynn Sockwell. I'm calling from Sandy Springs, Georgia. My belief is that the majority of Americans, especially those on the far right, and those, the white supremacist movement for sure, I believe that they are operating almost exclusively from a place of fight or flight. And then also, I think a great majority of Americans are in this shutdown mode where they do not even participate in the political system in a legitimate, informed, and educated way anymore.
Rodney Williams writes on Facebook, the Republican Party provided a home, a safe place for the alt-right, KKK, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists. Not much to be expected from white Republicans. Don't hold your breath. Carl Owens from Vidalia sends us an email. Make no mistake, Black Lives Matter is at its core a racist group, just as much as the Nazis. They should be called out in just as strong terms. All your guests blamed the Republican Party and Trump for all the racist trouble in our country. This is simple-minded and shows a liberal bias. Our country is mostly conservative. Starting all these discussions from the left immediately turns some people off to a healthy debate and eventually leads them to act out in drastic ways. Brian Greer tweets this, the problem is not race as much as it is the ideology. Clearly not all white people believe in white supremacy. Ebony DeMose wrote a post to Facebook, before Trump got in, I expected condemnation. Now I expect political infighting. We are collecting your reactions to what happened in Charlottesville and would love to get your thoughts on what caused it and where we go from here. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. Or you can find us on social media, and we might feature your comments on the show. Football season is here or near in some schools, and also back worries over head injuries. A new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association gives us more details about the brain disease CTE. That's chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Researchers examined the brains of 202 deceased football players at the high school, college, and professional levels. Boston University researcher Anne McKee and her colleagues found nearly 9 out of 10 players had CTE.
This is something that needs to be addressed, something that we need to figure out what's happening in football so that we can identify this lesion when it's first starting and try to either prevent it from getting worse or try to treat it and keep it at this very mild stage.
There are still a lot of questions about the connection between contact sports and concussion. Steve Broglio is working to answer some of those. He oversees the Neurotrauma Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan and joins me from Ann Arbor. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
What exactly happens in a brain that leads to CTE? What are the steps that occur?
So what we believe, we don't actually know all the steps that occur, but what we believe is that when someone's hit in the head, either directly, you can imagine a helmet-to-helmet contact or a whiplash-type mechanism, there's a stretching of the brain tissue, and that releases a protein called tau, and we all have tau in our brain naturally, but it gets released out of the neuron. It changes in shape, it becomes a little bit stickier once it gets released, and then it deposits deep within the folds of the brain. So the slides that you may see on TV or on the internet or whatever with those dark stains on the brain tissue, that's the tau that's been released and then deposits in the brain tissue. And then that blocks, we believe, that blocks kind of the pathways that allows the brain to operate in a normal manner.
And is there a specific end result of CTE? Does it always result in a specific kind of damage to the brain and a specific kind of disability?
So CTE, that tau protein deposit, it is unique. The way it lays down in CTE is unique to other disorders and diseases. So it's different from Alzheimer's disease or frontal temporal dementia or other such cases. So that's what makes it unique. The clinical presentation, how people respond to that outwardly, is still much a matter of debate. And we don't have a good idea of what that looks like on the outside, which makes it very complicated to diagnose. There's no scan, there's no imaging tested blood test that we can use to diagnose CTE while somebody's alive. So we're really reliant on postmortem autopsies, very identical to what the Boston group has done to tell us if this person had it or not.
So then let's talk about what the Boston group has done and whether or not you were surprised by these results that nearly 90% out of 202 football players, and not just on the professional level, but going down even to high school, nearly 90% had some form of CTE. Did that surprise you?
Not entirely. They've done a series of work that has similar outcomes, anywhere from 90 to 95%, just depending on the sample they used. This latest paper in JAMA that you referenced earlier was just an addition, about 100 extra cases on 100 cases that they had published previously. So I'm not entirely surprised. I think what we do with this information and how we go forward is going to be very important.
Which is a good question. So let me play you this comment from GPB sports correspondent John Nelson. And he's talking about how where your school is might make a difference into how your injury is treated.
In the smaller schools that are in the more ruralized areas, you're not as necessarily as accessible to training staffs and hospital staffs. Yes, you do have ambulances that are required at every game, but sometimes even at practice, there may be opportunities or there may be situations where you don't have training staff there every day.
So as I understood it, there's not a whole lot that they can do for you for a concussion. How much does your either immediate treatment or expert treatment matter?
I think there's a fair amount that we can do. We've certainly come a long way in the last 15 to 20 years with how we manage the injury. I will say there is a dearth of athletic trainers available at high school, particularly at the high school level. I think somewhere in the neighborhood about 45% of schools in the country have access to a full-time athletic trainer. And they're the individuals on the front line that can really manage the injury. That being said, if somebody's not there, if they're not available, if an injury is suspected, you just pull them out. This is high school level. This is not national championships. This is not world championships. There's really no reason to let that kid keep playing if you have a suspicion of injury. Coach can do that. A parent can do that. So pull that athlete out and then allow them to get appropriate rest. Our thinking on rest has changed a bit in the last few years, where we used to have this kind of black box mentality. Put somebody in the closet, don't let them do anything cognitively or physically. Now we know we probably want them to rest for a solid 48 hours, maybe 72 hours, but then we can start progressing them back into their sport at a slow pace. And that seems to help the process along quite nicely.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Steve Brolio. He's the director of the Neurotrauma Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan. So then, Steve, let me play you this comment from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who was speaking to ABC News last year about how the league is responding to concussions.
I think when you look what we've done over the last 10 years, we've had 40 different rule changes that are all designed on making the game safer. We've invested in equipment changes that we're seeing, safety changes to the turf, which I think will help on impacts, including head impacts on the turf. So all of these things are going to take hold, and they take time.
What do we know about how equipment affects this? I remember reading a study in which they said, actually, it's safer if you don't play with helmets at all. How can equipment help?
So I would vehemently oppose the let's remove the helmet idea. We have helmets in football for a reason. Back in the 1920s, the sport was on the verge of being banned because of the number of skull fractures and deaths that occurred on the field. So certainly our number of concussions may go down if we remove helmets, but I don't think anybody would want to trade that for deaths on the field. Helmet technology has improved quite significantly in the last 10 years. There's incredible work that's been done by the Virginia Tech Group. Stefan Duma leads that, where they are ranking helmets based on their ability to mitigate concussion risk. And with that, the industry has responded. Everybody wants to have the top-rated helmet. So they are developing and building and selling better helmets to reduce concussion risk. I don't think a helmet will ever 100% eliminate the possibility of concussion, but we can make it better for sure. I think the next question then becomes, what do we do in sports that don't have helmets? So something like soccer is a good example, where we need to think about other techniques, and maybe that's where rule changes come in. Not allowing people to raise the elbow is a good example that FIFA implemented, and that reduced their concussion risk.
So then let's talk about kids and how different the risk is for a college player or a professional player as opposed to high school. Here's a Roger Goodell again speaking in that interview with ABC News. They asked him if he would let his son play football.
I would certainly encourage him to do it, and I would let him do it. I think there are tremendous values from playing the game of football. There are risks involved with anything in life, but what we need to do is make sure we show people how to get the most out of playing sports and do it safely.
So, I mean, clearly, if you're an NFL player, the risk of CTE is fairly high. But what about high school players?
So we don't have a strong understanding, even at the professional level, we don't have a strong understanding of what the real risk is. So if we look at this paper from the Boston Group, there's a very large selection bias, and they note that in the paper. So these are individuals that had cognitive problems at the time of death, or they died under maybe suspicious circumstances, and their bodies were donated to science or to the Boston Group so the families could have a better understanding of what happened. There's never been a study that has looked at CTE risk or rates across, let's say, everybody that played the game of football or took a sampling of everybody that ever played the game. So we don't have an understanding of what the risk actually is at the various levels of play. Now, presumably, people that play more and have more exposure, the professional athlete, are at higher risk, but that makes up a very, very small sliver of people that play football in general. The bulk of people play 2, 3, maybe 4 years of high school football and they're done. They don't have the opportunity to go on to college. And then even a smaller portion of people that make it to college make it to the professional level.
So do we know if there's a difference based on what position you play? I mean, I assume the kicker's fairly safe, but what about the quarterback? And does it matter which position you play?
I think your assumption would be my assumption as well. I think the kicker is probably the safest position on the field, other than maybe the bench warmer. But we don't have a strong sense of whether the quarterback has a different risk profile than, let's say, the offensive lineman. The reason being is, while the linemen may be involved in every play and they take more impacts to the head in total, the magnitude of those impacts, how hard they're being hit, is much, much lower than the quarterback, who, when he gets hit, it's typically quite severe. So we do not have a strong understanding of what that trade-off, fewer number of hits, greater magnitude, larger number of hits, smaller magnitude. We don't understand what that trade-off looks like in the long term.
So, I mean, we're going to take a break here in just a moment, but can we say that we have the equipment and the knowledge that we need to keep football players safe from CTE at this point?
I think we need to understand what the risk factors for CTE are. I think we are doing the things that we think are correct at this point. I don't think any medical professional is going to do anything but the best, what they feel is the best for the athlete. But we don't have a strong understanding of what causes CTE, why people get it, why some people get it, why some people don't. And I think a lot of research needs to focus in that area, and then we can start targeting those things that do result in the disease.
As Steve Broglio, he's the director of the Neurotrauma Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan. He's going to stay with us. We continue this conversation in just a few moments with a former Atlanta Falcon who is trying to change the way that kids think about football. Later this hour, we'll speak with a legendary music producer in Athens who has some new music for us. But if you have thoughts about football and brain injuries, we'd love to hear them. You know how to reach us on social media, or just call us at 404-500-9457. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking to Steve Broglio about head injuries in football. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found a high rate of chronic traumatic encephalopathy in the brains of 111 deceased NFL players. All but one had the degenerative brain disease. Broglio studies brain trauma in football and is director of the Neurotrauma Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan. Thanks for staying with us, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to bring Buddy Curry into this conversation. He's a former Atlanta Falcons linebacker and founder of a group called Kids and Pros. And Buddy joins us via Skype. Hi, Buddy.
Hey, Emily.
So this is Celeste. But Buddy, do you think that you ever had a brain injury or a concussion while you were playing?
Well, it's different now, a term different in terms of, yes, I did have several concussions of what we know now in term as concussions. When I played, they were called dings, and there were just momentary setbacks where you gathered yourself and then got back in the game. But yes, I had several.
So you basically kind of walked it off when you had a concussion and you were playing in the NFL.
I walked it off. I did the things that nowadays you know not to do, because I really opened myself up to second concussion syndrome, I did that several times.
So how does that change, Buddy? What has changed now, especially with the Kids in Pros program and how you deal with injury with the young people you work with?
Well, there's a major concern in America about the game of football, but I think in most sports where you have concussions, you know, in other words, you can play with a hurt finger or leg or arm, but not with a hurt brain, because when you see the outcome of people that have played for at the highest level for a long time, there's a high level of CTE and challenges. So what we've done is taken many things that the NFL is doing. I just applaud the NFL for leading the charge to make the changes in their game that are kind of matriculating and being forced down to the youth level now. So as a master trainer for USA Football's Heads Up program, I travel around and talk to associations and talk to what we call player safety coaches to educate them on the safety protocols to make it better, not only from a what do you do if a concussion happens, but let's prevent them by having less contact, by having contact with the shoulder and not the head, so minimizing head contact as well. And also talk about equipment and making sure that the equipment's properly fitted.
So, Steve, let me play you a comment from JerMichael Finley. He was a tight end for the Packers for 6 seasons. During that time, he had 5 concussions. And he's describing what happened to him when he took a hit to the crown of his helmet. This was during his last game in 2013. It was an injury that ended up basically causing him to retire at age 28. He suffered a bruised spinal cord. So here he is in June explaining what happened.
I faced the guy up. I took the slant route. Caught the ball, and when I lowered my head, he jammed my head, and it kind of like jammed my spinal cord, so instantaneously I like froze up. When you get a spinal cord concussion, your head is just like flops back and forth, and it felt like 100 bees was on me, stinging me.
I'd never heard, Steve, of a spinal cord concussion before. Is there such a thing as an extreme concussion and a mild concussion that's not worth worrying about?
So I'm not a physician. I'm a PhD researcher. But what he described there does not sound like a concussion to me. It sounds maybe perhaps a contused spinal cord or a bruised spinal cord. And the bee stinging is, I think we've all had that sensation. We bang our elbow on the corner of a table or a chair, and we get that stinging sensation in our hand. And that's similar to what I think he's describing. I don't know his case by any stretch. But, we used to classify concussions as kind of grade 1, 2, or 3 or simple and complex. There's a lot of terms that have been thrown around. Now we just say you have a concussion or you don't, although there may be modifiers that go with that. So we know that people with a history of concussion may take a little previous history of concussion, may take a longer time to recover. We know women take a little longer to recover. People with learning disabilities seem to take a little bit longer. Children take a little bit longer. So those are modifiers to the injury, but we don't look at them as 1, 2, or 3 or simple and complex anymore.
So, Buddy, how do you recognize a concussion? Do you think that we all of the people that you work with in Kids and Pros are trained now in how to recognize when someone's sustained a concussion?
Well, I think you need to be a medical professional to recognize a concussion. I think what we need to do is become spotters, and when there's a inkling of concern, then you take that kid out. So when in doubt, you take them out and you give them evaluated. Hopefully, with the 45% of the high schools that have trainers, that trainer can make the best judgment on keeping that person out of the game. But as youth coaches, which are a far majority of the participants, we need to make a best choice or best decision based on what we see and what we know, and then send that kid to a medical professional.
Steve, do you have kids?
I have a daughter, yes.
And would you let her play football?
I would let her play football if she chose to play football. Her personality does not fit the sport of football.
she's not ready to tackle people.
She's not aggressive by any stretch. She's not competitive by any stretch. It's just not who she is. But if we had a male, a boy, then and he wanted to play,
or a more aggressive female,
A more aggressive female, then I would not be opposed to it. I think I would be most concerned about who the coaching staff is and their ability to coach the game, teach the fundamentals of the game appropriately, and then what does the medical support look like around the game. Those would be the two things that I would most focus on. And for our family friends that have boys that are interested in playing, those are the things that I tell them to look for.
So, Buddy, I don't know if you've heard from parents who are concerned about their kids playing and worried about injury. What do you tell them?
Oh, it's a huge concern. And I echo everything Steve just said. And really, I applaud your perspective on this, Steve. You're doing the research, and you're in the kind of middle of that. But yes, parents, and I travel around the country, are very concerned about concussions and really don't have the education or understanding on what a concussion is, what are the signs and symptoms, and what do I need to do as a parent if I suspect a concussion with my child. And so what we do is kind of teach them those three things. Along with that, with equipment and hitting or teaching contact in a way that minimizes head contact, I think we hopefully can reduce the number of concussions and therefore increase the safety of the game of football.
That is former Atlanta Falcons player Buddy Curry. He's the founder of the group Kids and Pros. We also heard from Steve Broglio, director of the Neurotrauma Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan. Steve and Buddy, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me on.
It's our pleasure.
Teams lose players for a number of reasons, and sometimes those players are important. The WNBA Atlanta Dream's star player left for the season. The team is now in ninth place, and after its sixth straight loss on Friday to New York, the team still has exceeded many people's expectations after losing an important part of the team and could still make the playoffs. We're joined by GPB sports analyst and former WNBA player, Keisha Brown. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. First, let's talk about why it can be so devastating to a team. As soon as they lost their star player, everyone said, well, that's it for the Dream. Why?
Well, when you get into professional sports, you feel like you have to have that marquee player, that star player, that one player that's going to put you on the map. But I think a lot of times in professional sports, fans and what a lot of us fail to realize is that it still takes a team. And so even though you have someone like Angel McCautry that can put up stats in high volumes day in and day out, you've still got those high-velocity role players that can do the same thing, equivalent times three, because now if you get two or three players that can give you that same type of statistical output than one person can, now you kind of formulated that team.
So how much does gameplay change when you lose somebody who is a reliable scorer? Does it change your style of play?
I don't think it really changes your style of play. All it does is just gives the next man up the opportunity. And, when you talk about professional sports and you talk about injuries or people just being absent for the game, if you will, it's always the next man up. So it's always the opportunity for somebody else to step up and be there for their team.
So then let's talk about the Atlanta Dream's team and their makeup and why they're still able to do so well. What do you see in their gameplay that's working for them?
Well, I can just say from experience, I've had the opportunity to play under Michael Cooper when I played in Los Angeles. And he is a person of, I'll say, just individualism and understanding individual tendencies per player. And he does that very well within his team. He gave me the opportunity as an undrafted athlete to be his starting point guard for a season. So, he sees things in players that maybe a lot of other teams can't see, which is why he drafts and him and the Atlanta Dream makes the moves the way they make the move. But then you have players like Tiffany Hayes. You've got great post players that have been traded in, or he's given them the opportunity to play. He had a great draft pick in Sykes from Syracuse. So you've got a lot of these young players that are willing to step up. Larice McLaren, that was a trade from Indiana. She's now the point guard, ended up being an all-star for Atlanta this summer. So you have players like that that can come in and fill those roles and do them well.
And if you don't follow the Atlanta Dream, Michael Cooper, she was speaking of, former NBA player, but also in his fourth season, I think, as a head coach of the Atlanta Dream. Now, they've just experienced their sixth straight loss. That's not the same in basketball as it is in football.
Right.
In football, your season is done. In basketball, they could still make
it happen.
The playoff. Yeah. So how do you come out as a player? How do you come out from a string of losses?
Well, you know, and I'm speaking on experience with this. When you play in the WNBA, the season goes by so fast.
There's so many games.
It's you're playing 32 games within the course of 3 months. And so if you're not playing, you're traveling. And so there's just a lot of time that you can make it up within a span. Even though they've lost six straight right now, they can go ahead and win the next six games, and then the eight teams above them, they lose one or two, and Atlanta's right back in it. So, I mean, they're right under that line of making the playoffs. And I think the beauty about what the WNBA has done recently is they've let go of the conferences. So now you have one huge conferences. They have each team that plays each other, I think, three times. And they take the top eight for the playoffs. And I think that's great for the game.
So are we making headway? We're not going to engage in discussion about how athletic women's sports are, because that is ridiculous. Go watch a game. You'll see how athletic these athletes are.
Exactly.
But are we making headway in terms of getting an equitable amount of attention and respect for women's sports?
I think it's getting there. You know, I think one of the biggest things that we as female athletes have to continue to do is just be a platform and be a way for this game. The people before me, the Teresa Edwards, Dawn Staley, Cheryl Swoops, Lisa Leslie, Tina Thompson, those are the women that paved the way for me and my generation to play. And we have to do it differently than the guys, because honestly, it's just different. It's just different
in
than
what
the way.
What do you mean?
Well, okay, if you think about it right now, the WNBA has been in survival for 21, 22 years. And the NBA has been over 60. So if you want to go back and see how much the men were making financially in their 22nd year, then we can have a discussion. But you can't sit here and put the, you know, professional women's basketball on the same map as the men, and you've got a 40-year gap in between that. So, you know, if you want to do the same
playing apples field, to apples, yeah.
Absolutely. Then let's go ahead and draw back the guys 40 years and put them in their 21, 22 year mark, and then let's see where we are.
Do you think, I mean, there's so much attention on especially UConn and some of the college sports for women. Does that begin to bleed over when those players that people watch in college then get drafted?
Oh, absolutely. I actually think it starts in the recruiting process from high school to college, because, you know, these kids want it quick and fast. Let's be honest. I'm going to be candid here. They want it quick and fast. And if they know that they can go somewhere that's almost going to guarantee them a championship within the 4 years that they compete at the college level, these kids are going to go there. You know, now it's the challenge of, you know, other individuals to be like, hey, I want to step up. I want to put this school on the map. I want to be the first, you know, and this is why a lot of us chose Georgia.
Right. Okay. So
yeah.
Then let's talk about the Atlanta Dream's chances.
Sure.
Do you think they're going to make it to the playoffs?
You know, I think they will. I haven't looked at the bottom end of their schedule, but I'm sure that they're probably carving out the games that they know that they can win, and the games that it's just going to be a toss-up, you know, as soon as that ball goes up in the air. They have the ability and the capacity to get some good games under their belt and be able to compete. And last time I checked, like I said, they were maybe a half a game behind, maybe a game now behind eighth place. And all you need is to get in that eighth place spot.
And they play tonight at 7 p.m. Against the Connecticut Sun. Is there a particular kind of team that the Atlanta Dream is? Like, are they an offensive team? Are they a defensive team? Or what are they, passers? What kind of team are they?
Well, they're a defensive team. If you're Michael Cooper, you're a defensive team. You're not going to get too far without playing some defense, you know. So he's always been that type of defense, rebound, and run type of coach, and he has those workhorses to be able to do that. They just got to make sure that, you know, when they come out these next four or five games, if they got to be able to hit first.
that hit first, but that's aggressive offense.
It is, but that's also kind of putting yourself on a map as far as defensively. How are they going to be able to defend teams and stop teams and get out and run?
Okay, fair enough. That is GPB Sports Analyst Keisha Brown. She has high hopes for the Atlanta Dream. Let us know if you think, or if you're a fan, we want to know if you think they're going to make it into the playoffs. Keisha, thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
She's got high hopes. Just ahead, Athens music producer David Barbie is back. He has a brand new album, his first solo album in about 7 years. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. David Barbie is a name well known in the Athens music scene. He runs the famed Chase Park Transduction Recording Studio and has produced albums for Drive By Truckers, Deer Hunter, New Madrid, and a bunch of others. As a performer, Barbie played bass for the band Sugar and made a name with his solo projects as well. This week, he releases his third solo album. It's called Tenth of Seas. I caught up with David Barbie back in June. So you have been such a prolific collaborator in the past, and yet on this album you chose to play all the instruments yourself. Why?
Celeste, I got into recording because I wrote songs when I was a kid. I've always written songs. And I had a four-track, originally a reel-to-reel four-track, and then by the time I was a little older, teenager, a four-track cassette machine that I would play everything on myself, and that was just my way of conveying my songs, which led to me playing in bands, and I had a way to teach people the songs. And it also led to me producing records. It all started with me making these four-track recordings of me playing everything initially in my parents' basement and then just wherever else, band practice space, you know, bedroom, whatever, over the years. And I have always made demos of songs with every band I've ever played with. Did it with Mercy Lynn, did it with Sugar, did it with the Quick Hooks. And on this most recent batch of songs, I would teach various people the songs, and it would be better in some ways, but it would lose something in others. And so I kept going back to these demos and realized that there was some odd thing about it that I kind of liked. And I also really liked the immediacy of it. The conveyance of emotion of recording something, in some cases, moments after the idea hits you, and trying to get it as close to the source of inspiration as possible. I played demos of songs for a couple of friends who I play music with, a couple of the Quick Hooks guys, Frank McDonald and John Mills, and they both had asked, well, who's playing the drums on that? And I said, well, I am. And Frank said, you should just record it like that. And I started thinking about it and realized, I think I'm just going to do it. So one thing led to the other, and so I just kind of made this record of me as close to the point of inspiration as I could get it.
Although you ended up with a lot more than four tracks, it sounds like.
This is not done on the four-track cassette. I did this on analog tape, though, which is a very important distinction, not to be an analog purist or a snob or anything. But I did it because it's not as easy to fix things on analog tape as it is on a computer. The amazing powers of Pro Tools or any digital audio workstation, and they are amazing, provide us great creative pathways, but also a lot of creative crutches where you can make things that aren't in tune, in tune. You can make things that aren't in time, in time. You can fix things, but you can also like rub the feel and rub human emotion out of things. So by doing it all on tape, I really couldn't use my years of studio wizardry to fix things. I basically, and especially with me running back and forth in the studio to the control room, I pretty much had to play everything on there is pretty much an end-to-end performance. As for the four track, no, it is on 2-inch 16 track, which is my favorite of all the analog tape formats. And but on some of the songs on the album, there really are only like 6 or 7 takes. Like I will use like 2 or 3 mics on the drums. And it's there's some songs where the vocal and the guitar is just one mic in front of me. And I've just kind of got to, again, like I was a kid, I've just kind of got to either play the guitar harder or sing a little louder or you know, just basically make a human adjustment for, as a mix adjustment.
Well, let's actually hear some music here. This is the first single from the album. It's called Portuguese Door. So this way that you have recorded the album, how does that then affect a live performance?
I've always looked at live performances and records as two different expressive mediums. So for the live performances, what I'm doing, I'm not a one-man band. I'm not playing everything myself live like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins. I have enlisted my friends New Madrid, with whom I have produced 4 albums so far. The way all this came together, I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit, but the way this came together is I was playing with their drummer one night when I was in the middle of working on this and showing him the new songs. And Alex Woolley said, "These songs are great. I love playing this. I think the other guys would be into doing this too." And it took about 5 minutes, and I formulated this idea of, what if we did a tour where you guys are my band and we open for New Madrid? Or in some cities, it wound up where New Madrid opened for David Barbie and Inward Dream Up. And he said, "I love it. I think they would too." We talked about it the next day. And within about 3 days, I'd worked out my record deal with Orange Twin and talked to their agent, Jesse Rossoff with United Talent in New York, about booking the tour. And there we go. And about 2 weeks later, I had a finished record and went to New York and mastered it because I had to get it done if we're actually going to do this tour this summer. So live, yeah, it is me backed by New Madrid. And those guys really know the songs. We just got back from a 2-week run up to New York and back. And they've really got the feel of this down. And there's some things, some of Ben Hackett's bass lines are note for note what I did, but kind of his own take on it, just, you know, as far as the feel goes. But it's as close as I would want it to be, but it kind of, having different people play it makes it kind of a new game every night, which is cool for me.
Let's hear another song. The album's called Comet of the Season. This song is called You're Out. Blast away all the cynicism. All the paranoia and doubt. All your invasions of self-pity too. That song is from your album called Comet of the Season, and it's called You're Out. So one of the things that you do, and that's not just on this song, but the playing sometimes with rhythm and getting both playful with it. I wonder, when you're writing tunes, how much you innovate and go for surprise, and how much you go for a hook.
That's a great question. I try, and I pretty much follow my muse 100% of the time when it comes to songwriting.
You don't strategize it.
No. There are songwriters that I've worked with, amazing songwriters, who are true craftsmen. That is, they're methodical. They have a pattern in which they write things. It's thought out. This time signature goes here, et cetera, et cetera. And then I've worked with other people who are complete fits of inspiration, and I pretty much fall into the latter category and have for a long time. When I was younger, I wrote songs in a more standard way where I was aware of verse, chorus, time signature, et cetera. But over time, I get an idea for a song. I don't think I'm hardly the only person that does it this way, where it's almost like I just hear it in my head. Sometimes it's like a complete thing. And I try and get it out either on a piece of paper or onto some sort of recording, whether that could be like in my phone. Again, as close to this point of inspiration as I can, and I do a lot better. I get results that are more satisfying to me when I am more feeling and less thinking.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Athens musician and producer David Barbee. His new album is called Tenth of Seas. But both your parents worked with big bands, right?
Yes.
So I wonder, you know, because look, it takes a unique person to be successful as both a solo musician and someone who plays in bands and is a producer. That requires someone who can really work well with very different personalities. And I wonder what you learned from your parents about that. Having to work with big bands would also require you to play well with the team.
My parents were big band musicians. My mom was a singer and an actress. My dad played baritone, sax, and clarinet. It was a composer and musical arranger, and was also the tour manager at times of his career for the bands he was playing in. It's not like it was today where there's an independent tour manager. It was just one of the band members typically was just, you'll make a couple of extra bucks, but somebody's got to arrange the hotels and the itineraries, etc. So, working with all these different people in all these different ways does absolutely require an ability to work with all kinds of people. And for me, I think that comes pretty easily because I like all kinds of people. I find the differences in people to be fascinating and to be rewarding. And if we were all the same kind of music, the same personalities, even in terms of things that can be troublesome in some ways, just like a more mercurial personality is interesting. You know, it takes all kinds. Variety is the spice of life. As far as my parents go, I did learn probably quite a bit just sitting around the dinner table every night, because as most nights, my parents were coming home from a studio or maybe a musicians' union board meeting, or it could have been a concert somewhere. My mom could have had a voiceover gig or something. So my life was filled with creative personalities, stories about those people and just what went on during the day. And, you know, the best advice I ever got from anybody was from my dad, who had told me as a young man to never give myself anything to fall back on, because you'd fall back on it, and that instead I should just do what I loved in life, and if that didn't work out, I'd have to figure out something else. So I have pursued that, and so when that is working in the studio, that's what I'm doing, and if it is working with students at UGA, that's what I'm doing, and if it is traveling around the country in a van and playing music with a band, that's what I'm doing. And if it's writing songs, that's certainly what I'm doing.
So let's actually hear a little bit from the band Sugar. This song is called If I Can't Change Your Mind. When you're writing a song, whether it's best used on a solo album or on an album with a band, or maybe best played by someone else?
I usually have a pretty good feel when I'm writing songs where I think it goes. For me, most of my career, my own musical output has been either I am in a band, I am working solo. But the 90s, the Sugar Days, definitely was an era of three distinct possibilities of output for me. One was songs that would wind up on Sugar Records. Two would be songs that I might play with Buzz Hungry, who was an Athens band I was playing with at the time. And third would be other people covering my songs. At one point, I had songs on a recently released Sugar album, songs on a Buzz Hungry album, and a song on a K.D. Lang album all happen right at the same time, which was pretty cool. As far as K.D. goes, there was a version of that song on Comet of the Season and on her album, Drag. And sometimes somebody else doing the song, it's something I have never pursued. It's usually something where somebody's come to me. In the case of K.D. Lang, Eddie Gomez, that what used to be known as Bug Music, it's now part of BMG Chrysalis, approached me and said she's got a new album, she's looking for songs, and I think that she's looking for something like this, and I think that you could write it and would be perfect. And it was the weirdest thing where I told him, it's like, man, I have like two lines I wrote about two nights ago that I think are exactly what you're talking about. Let me see if I can finish this thing up and send it your way and see what we got. And I did, and he liked it, and she dug it and put it on a record, and there you go.
And what song was that?
It was on her album. It is known as Your Smokescreen. On Comet of the Season, it's known as Medicine Takeover, but it's the same song.
So this, with this new solo album and touring it live, is this a one-off? I mean, are you gonna? Do you feel like this is a style for you in terms of doing solo albums where you record everything yourself and then it changes however it might change when someone else plays it live?
So far, so good. I mean, quite possibly. I see two avenues for my own songwriting for the next couple of years. One is that, yeah, I really did love the experience of doing this. I loved capturing the immediacy of it. There's none of it I listen to that I regret. I favor things that, again, are like, and it's funny, in life, of course, I'm a chronic overthinker, just like a lot of people are. But when it comes to making music, I do greatly value the moment of inspiration. But doing the last 2 weeks of shows with New Madrid, now I'm considering the idea, I'm mulling over how can we make a record together in this configuration. So I'm just hoping to continue moving forwards. Forwards is always the more interesting direction for me rather than looking back. So hopefully I'll just keep on moving forwards and changing. And as far as making another record like this goes, quite likely, because I enjoyed it and I'm so far pretty happy with the results.
David Barbee, his album is called Tenth of Seas. David, thank you so much.
Celeste, thanks for having me.
David Barbee performs at the Georgia Theater in Athens tonight at 9 p.m. and also at Atlanta Bar 529 at 9. And that's our show for today, but we love to hear your thoughts. We talked earlier this hour about concussions. So I wonder if there's a sport that you're concerned about letting your kid play, or a sport you wouldn't let them play because of worry over injury. How do you keep them safe while they're playing sports? Call and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought for GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day. Body made, casino.